conference. I'm Harvey Brown from the University of Oxford. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce to you Samson Abramsky. I'm sure that he doesn't need any introduction to this audience. But let me just mention that Professor Abramsky did his undergraduate degree in philosophy at the University of Cambridge. He then did his PhD at Queen Mary College in London in computer science and stayed on to work there for some years. He then went to the University of Edinburgh.
Oh, that was Imperial College, probably.
Imperial College.
Over.
Anyway, he ended up at the University of Oxford in 2000 as the professor of computer science. And it's a pleasure to hand over to you, Samson.
Thanks very much, Harvey. I've been trying to live my past down with limited success for many years, but there you go, you can't escape these things, I suppose. Okay, so firstly, thanks to the organizers for inviting me to speak at this very nice meeting. So this is going to be a sort of exploratory talk, which I hope will be of interest. It'll be partly expository and partly just some explorations of how some classical material from foundations, and particularly category theoretic views of foundations of logic and mathematics and so on, may have some relevance for foundations of quantum mechanics. So let's begin with something about diagonal arguments, which is what our main theme is going to be. Now, diagonal arguments, as I'm sure you all know, lie at the root of many fundamental phenomena in the foundations of logic and mathematics. And since diagonals, being on the diagonal, involves really the operation of the diagonal, namely of copying or cloning, that already suggests that it may not be so far removed from fundamental considerations of physics, because we know that one of the key distinctions between classical and quantum physics is the availability or not of a suitable kind of cloning or copying operation. So we're going to, our starting point is going to be a classic work by Lorvier from 40 years ago, where he analyzed diagonal arguments as they arise in the foundations of logic and mathematics, and showed in a categorical language that there's a very simple and general argument which underlies actually quite a remarkable range of results when we look at the full range of this. I'm assuming that this is not entirely familiar to everyone here, so I'm going to spend some time actually going through some of this material. I think it's very fascinating material, which I think anyone concerned with foundations should be aware of. And in particular, what's interesting for us here particularly perhaps is that it very clearly, this general argument very clearly exposes the role of a diagonal, in other words, a copying operation. So we're going to look at some of this, and then we're going to generalize Lorvier a bit, so we see how it works in the setting of monoidal categories, which is the setting for a lot of the foundational approaches that we'll be hearing about for quantum mechanics over the next few days, and showing just how much we need of copying in that general setting in order to carry this argument through. Lorvier's original treatment was in a Cartesian setting where everything, you had essentially everything that you needed as far as copying and deleting operations are concerned. And another aspect of this, which was not so much spelled out by Lorvier, but emerged in some later work in the computer science context, is that these ideas can also be used to give no-go results in structural foundations of, could be logic, mathematics, or foundations of computation, but also quite also the same kind of approach can be carried through in the foundations of physics as well. So the no-go results are of a structural nature, and what the kind of thing they're saying is that various structural features cannot be combined on pain of a collapse of the structure. So we get an inconsistency and by an incoherence of combining certain kinds of structural features. And recently I've sort of given a categorical version of no cloning in those terms, which is quite close to some results in categorical logic. And what we'll show is that the diagonal arguments also lead to results about incoherence of structural features of this kind. Now, in the quantum realm, we don't have diagonals, and the situation is less clear-cut. In a way, the absence of diagonals means apparently less chance for paradox to arise, we might say. And what I'll do is to look at the issue of what kinds of reflexive or self-referential structure do arise in the setting of Hilbert space, really as a sort of just a preliminary look at how these ideas carry through into the quantum realm. Okay, so let's begin with a basic core argument, which is very simple, but my opinion, a naive approach to mathematics tends to despise simplicity, but actually the deepest ideas are often very simple, but also not quite so simple when you look at them more deeply, and this is certainly true in foundational work. And I'm going to start with a concrete formulation where we just work with sets and functions, so we can get the basic pattern of the argument, and then we'll see how to generalize it in an abstract setting. So we're starting off concretely working with sets and functions. And the basic situation is the following. We have a function that's going from a set X into the set of functions from X into some given set V. And of course we can, we can form function spaces in sets. We have a Cartesian closed structure, but if we're not so comfortable with this, we know that we can equivalently, just by transferring variables across, view such a function in terms of its exponential transpose, which takes pairs of values from X and maps them into V. Now, the way we want to read this, the reason I've called the sort of target set V, is that although there's sort of nothing special we're assuming about it, we might think of it as a set of possible values or outcomes. So we can think of V to the X as predicates on X valued in V. So V might be a familiar set like the usual set of truth values, but it might be anything else. So what G is showing is how predicates on X can be represented by elements of X. So a predicate is represented by anything in its pre-image under G. And in fact, we can write this out in terms of the exponential transpose G hat. We can say that the predicate P on X is representable by an element of X if that element, so to speak, codes the predicate, so that for every value we could apply P to, its value is given to us by G hat with X put in the first argument. So X is a code, so if you think of G as a kind of universal predicate simulator, the code X is telling us which predicate we're simulating at the moment, and then given that, it should behave on any Y, a second input, exactly as that predicate P would have done. Okay, so it's just trivially spelling out the definitions, but looking at them from a certain point of view. And if you think of predicates on X as talking about X, expressing properties of X, then if we code predicates on X in X, then we're allowing X, in a sense, to talk about itself. So this is where self-reference comes in. Now, that's a sort of general situation, but we might want, in the way that in sort of logic and foundations we often do want to take things to the maximum, and we want to consider the situation where every predicate on X is representable on X. And this just comes to the condition that this function G should be surjective. So if G is surjective, then for every predicate P, there's going to be some element X which represents P in the set X itself. Okay. And what we want to ask is, when can this happen? So here is the basic little lemma, which is going to be presented as a positive and perfectly constructive lemma in the given data, which tells us the consequences of assuming that we can represent predicates, all predicates, in this fashion. So we suppose that there is a surjective function allowing us to represent V-valued predicates on X in X. Then every function on V, every endo function on V has a fixed point, an element of V which is mapped by that function alpha to itself. And this is for every function. So it's a very strong consequence. And as we'll see in a moment, in this familiar setting of sets and functions, something of a paradoxical consequence. And here is the argument, which is very simple, perfectly constructive. We simply define a particular predicate P from the given data, namely our function G or its exponential transpose G hat, and the given function alpha that we want to exhibit a fixed point for. And very importantly, we have this component here, the diagonal, which copies an element of X. And of course, it lands us on the diagonal, which is exactly going to be in the situation where the function G gets applied to X and X, X in both positions, so X both as code and as data. So we just defined P as this composition, and now, of course, what we want to evaluate it on is, since we're assuming that G is surjective, that says exactly that there's an element of X which represents any predicate, and in particular represents this predicate P. So we evaluate it on that X. Now this is just unfolding the definition that we have from this diagram, and this is just what the diagonal does. So that's just the definition of P of X. But now we look at this in a different way, and we remember that X was chosen as the element of the set X which represents P, and therefore G hat of XX is by definition P of X. That's what representability means. And we see that what we've calculated is that P of X is a fixed point of alpha. So that's it. That's the whole argument. Now, a reasonable question to ask is, this is a bit crazy, isn't it? When is this going to make sense? Bearing in mind that we're working in the specific concrete setting of sets and functions. And we'll use the terminology that a set, or later an object in a category, has the fixed point property if every endo function on it has a fixed point. Now, it's very easy to see that that no set with more than one element has the fixed point property. And the minimal example is the two-element set where we have the familiar negation function. So that does not have a fixed point. So therefore, when we look at this theorem in set, we have to take it, what its force is, it has to be taken contrapositively. But the idea that there could be a surjective map is just wrong, provided that V has more than one element. So let's see what we can do with that. But before we do that, let's just say that this is in with classical set theory, but we saw that the argument was constructive. And actually, this argument is going to work in any elementary topos suitably formulated. We have to be a bit careful about how we say has more than one element. But there is an analog of this result in any reasonable model of set theory, even if the model of set theory is intuitionistic rather than classical, to put it in more logical terms. And a few comments on this proof, simple as it is. Firstly, as we've already said, it's constructive. From the given data, we produce the fixed point explicitly. And there was that step where we used two descriptions of P. That's somehow the subtlety of it, as is often the case with such things. So it's just worth, I think, spelling that out. I've been pressing too many buttons. Yes, stop. All right. Does let us have a quiet moment to think. All right, so here we just used the definition of P, and here we recalled the fact that by definition G had this universal representational capacity, so that we could represent P through X and put it those.
Let's do that again. And the final point is that we chose the X that represented P. So if we look again at this innocent looking expression P of X, it's not quite so innocent, because indirectly through this representation, it's actually a self-application. P is being applied to something that represents itself. Of course, as we know from family calculus and so on, self-application is closely related to these phenomena. So let's look at a couple of immediate applications. First one, you'll know the original form of the diagonal argument is Cantor's theorem. Can you still hear me? I'm going to cross this microphone somewhere over there.
Can people hear me at the back? Right. Okay, so we just apply it directly in this basic case where the set of values is the usual two-element truth value set. And we conclude, as usual in Cantor's argument, that there is no surjective map of that kind, and therefore that the cardinality of the power set cannot be less than or equal to the cardinality of the set we started off with. Of course, in classical set theory, that means it has to be greater. And in fact, the way that the usual diagonal argument works is to assume for a contradiction that there is such a surjective map, apply the fixed point lemma with this is the two element set, so we take our function to be the usual negation function that we just showed, which is fixed point free, and therefore we get what is exactly the usual diagonalization argument, where we show by contradiction that that wasn't a surjective map after all. And on the other hand, we can take Russell's paradox. So now we take some universe, some set of sets, and we take the membership relation and its characteristic function to give us our function G, or the transpose G hat. How we use this is to argue as follows, that there is a predicate which can be defined on S, which makes perfectly good sense, and which cannot be representable by any element of S. We get that exactly. So we fix the G in this case. Again, we take alpha, the function that we're getting the fixed point of for a contradiction in the fixed point lemma, to be negation in the two-element set. And if you unfold the argument that we just gave in this case, what we get here as what would be the fixed point would be exactly the standard Russell set. So the set of all elements that are not members of themselves. And the conclusion we draw from this is that there is a predicate we can define on this given universe of sets which cannot itself be represented by a set. So if we form a well-defined collection of sets, they're not rich enough to represent all the predicates. That's just the contrapositive of the usual way of putting it, which is that if you have a set theory with a naive comprehension axiom, which tells you that every predicate that you can write down using the membership relation and logic does define a set, then you get an inconsistent theory. So really, the way that the argument is structured in this fashion gives us perhaps the right way of looking at it, that any collection, any coherent collection of sets which is consistent cannot be closed under naive comprehension. And that's exactly the sort of lesson that was learned in the historical development of set theory, where one had to replace naive comprehension, the idea that every predicate on set, on the universe of sets, could be representable by a set, by more cautious principles, leading to the usual kind of system such as Zermelo-Frankel set theory. Okay, so this is the sort of concrete setting. Now let's look at the abstract version of this basic lemma. So Lovere's argument was in the setting of Cartesian closed categories, which was natural setting at that time and leading on historically to the development of topos theory and sort of categorical setting for set theory. What we want to do is to put it into a setting of monoidal categories, isolating exactly which properties of the diagonal are needed. So let's suppose that we have a monoidal category, and we're going to look at some minimal properties of a copying operation. So firstly, there should be a family of maps, the right shape to be diagonals. So for every object A, there should be an arrow, a map going from A to A tensor A. So something that has the right shape to be a diagonal. And it turns out that all that we need are two very rudimentary instances of properties of such a copying operation. So in the usual idea in category theory, we think of points as arrows coming out of, in this case, in a monoidal category, the unit object. So a point is something that has no inputs. It just gives you a value in the codomain type. So in the category of Hilbert spaces, the points would correspond to the vectors, to the states, because the unit would just be the ground field. And in a Cartesian category such as sets, the unit would be the terminal object, and you just have a function picking out an element of the set in the codomain. So points are the arrow-theoretic way of talking about elements, and here we're just asking for naturality with respect to points. For any point of a type A, if we copy the point, we get the same thing as if we tensor up two copies here, where this has told us how to go from one copy of the unit to two. This is something that we don't have in Hilbert spaces, in fact. We can define a diagonal, choosing a basis on a Hilbert space, we can define a map of this shape, which does have various nice properties. In particular, it does correctly copy the elements of the chosen basis. So it's just the thing which is a diagonal with respect to the members of a given orthonormal basis, but it won't in general satisfy this copying property with respect to points. And the other property we're going to need is just monoidality at the unit type, which is just this trivial fact that what this does is the same thing as the canonical isomorphism between I tensor I and I. So this is as little as we could ask of a copying operation with respect to naturality and being compatible with a monoidal structure, as one could imagine. And now here's the abstract version of, we can do an abstract version of the fixed point lemma. By the way, I mean, from a category theorist point of view, it's not very nice to talk about points, and I have been upbraided sometimes by category theorists in the past for definitions that involve reference to points, but my defense can be that we find a heavily point-based definition in Lorvier's classic paper from 40 years ago, because indeed, to make this argument, we do need to refer to points. So Lorvier's definition is that an arrow of this shape, I mean, he had a product, he was working in a Cartesian setting, but it comes to the same thing, is weakly point surjective. If for every, again, we think of this as a predicate. You see, this is just a categorical version of the definition of representability that we had before concretely with sets and functions. If for every V-valued predicate on A, there's a point, an element of A, which is going to code the predicate, meaning that for every point Y of A, the effect of evaluating the predicate on Y is the same as tensoring up X and Y. So X is the code and Y is the actual input, and then applying this binary operation that's simulating any predicate that you like. So this is just the categorical version of the concrete definition we wrote before. And in that case, we say that P is represented by X, okay, because it works for all Y. Okay, and now we can do our abstract fixed point lemma. So let C be a monoidal category with point diagonals if F is one of these weakly point surjective maps, then every endomorphism on V has a fixed point. And of course, what we mean by a fixed point can be expressed categorically again in this fashion. A point which is left unchanged by applying f to it, alpha to it rather. And this makes sense in this generality. By the way, I mean, just think of Hilbert spaces. Every linear map in the most trivial possible way does have a fixed point, namely the boring old zero vector. So it's not that we're saying that the world collapses, we're just giving a structural property here relating certain features. And here is the argument. Again, we define a predicate. So you see, this is essentially the same argument we did before concretely, but just written in the abstract language now. We have all the right definitions in place. So here's our representing function f, and we define p by applying the diagonal, plays an essential role in the argument, of course, applying f, and then this endomorphism alpha, which we want to exhibit a fixed point of. And here is the calculation to show that p applied to x is indeed a fixed point of alpha. So we see we unfold the definition. We use point naturality and point monoidality. And now again, we use this other way of describing p, namely the fact that since f had this property of weak point surjectivity, p has a representation given by the element x, and that's the very one we've chosen to evaluate on. And therefore, we recognize that this expression is the same as p applied to x, p composed with x. And we've shown that p of x is a fixed point of alpha. Okay, so now let's look at further applications. And they're really, it's quite an amazing thing that how many applications there are where this is the basic core nugget of argument that lies inside them. So let's look at a rather sort of famous setting for this kind of thing, the world of metamathematics. Now, one does this carefully, you sort of take at least 10 lectures setting up all the right definitions and so on, and it's all a bit heavy, and I'm just going to do this in a slide. So, but I guess you've all heard something about this. So we're looking at theories that are able to encode their own syntax. Actually, a lot of this is all really just programming, and if we were able to accept that a decent theory should include Haskell or something as part of it, then life would be a lot simpler. But usually one takes a formal theory of arithmetic. So we have terms for numerals, and enough primitive recursive functions are representable within the formal theory. So you can prove that, you know, a term representing some primitive recursive function, say some polynomial or something, that applied to a given numeral is equal to the output of the function, that sort of thing. That's what we mean by representable. So the theory, proof theoretically, is strong enough to do some basic programming in. And then in the way that the classic way, going back to Gödel, we code formulas by numbers and then by numerals corresponding to the numbers. And we use this programming that we have to represent syntactic operations effectively in this numbering. And we use the usual notation of Quine corners, so B in these upper square brackets is the Gödel number of the formula B. And in particular, we assume that there is a recursive function D representable in the system, which just does this syntactic operation. So it picks up the Gödel number of some formula B with one free variable X in it, and it gives us back the Gödel number of the formula that you get by substituting for the x the Gödel number of the formula b of x. So if you have your hands on the syntax, that's a trivial thing to describe, just doing substitution. And yet this is the real devil in the whole thing. This is a diagonal. It's making two copies of b of x. And again, indirectly via Gödel numbering, it's doing self-application. This is where the real devil is. In the whole enterprise. So, and if you have, you know, actually a surprisingly small amount of primitive recursive arithmetic, you can do this kind of thing. And then the key result is actually, in this setting, a fixed point lemma. May not be the one that gets into the sort of Time magazine's list of 20 most important scientific contributions of the 20th century, like. But this is the key result. It's a fixed point lemma, which says the following. for every formula in one free variable, there's a formula C, which is a fixed point of it inside the theory, meaning that inside the theory we can prove that C is equivalent, if and only if, to E with the Gödel number of C substituted in for its argument. That's the key result. And I'm not going to go through the proof. It is a direct application of the same kind of argument modulo all these coding functions. And in fact, we again can constructively produce this C. And you see it's again G applied to the Gödel number of G of X, where G picks up this parameter and it does the diagonal. So you see it's the same, if you think of D as corresponding to the diagonal and then the application of this representing function that we had before, and then E is like the alpha, the endomorphism that we had before, it's really unfolding the same kind of structure as we've seen in our fixed point lemma. And it can be made to fit exactly in that pattern. And for those who know lambda calculus, you should see that this is really corresponds to applying a fixed point combinator, the y combinator of lambda calculus, where the again this self-application here is mediated by the Gödel numbering. But it's the same kind of idea where E is going to be the actual parameter picking up for this variable F. It's exactly that. And by the way, that connection is by no means accidental. Curry came by the fixed point combinator by analyzing Russell's paradox and saw that the essential point there was substitution and copying of arguments. And the lambda calculus also historically came from the same roots. Okay, so that's the key result. But I suppose we do want to see the things that figured in the Times magazine's list of the 20 most important contributions of 20th century science. So let's draw some trivial corollaries from this. The first one is Gödel's first incompleteness theorem. Of course, I'm kidding, but Gödel's first incompleteness theorem really is a simple corollary of this, where we simply take the formula E. Again, we can code, you know, when sequences of formulas form, or the Gödel numbering of a sequence of formulas is a proof in the formal system of the Gödel number of some other formula. So that gives us this predicate prove. And we can simply take our sentence to be the statement that for all y, y is not a proof of x. So a fixed point of this sentence E is, in the classical Gödel way, a sentence asserting its own unprovability. And provided the theory is consistent, that sentence can't be provable in the theory. And another famous corollary is Tarski's theorem, that the truth is not definable in the formal theory. So if T is a putative truth predicate for the theory, so that A is true, if and only if we can prove in the theory T holds of the Gödel number of A, then we could take E to be not T, and again a fixed point contradicts this assumed property of T, and we can conclude that no such T exists. So that's Tarski's theorem on the undefinability of truth in the formal theory. And there are lots more applications. There's a very nice survey paper by Nosson Janowski. I'll give a few references at the end, which covers semantic paradoxes, the halting problem, the fact that P versus NP doesn't relativize, Parikh sentences, which is about refining the Gödel theorems with respect to length of proofs, things in recursion theory, and all sorts of things, and many more can be treated in this fashion. So it's an amazingly fecund little lemma. Okay, how much time do I have left? That would be 5 minutes. Okay. Right. So well, let's quickly look at a different perspective on these results and a different way of using them. So we've kind of used inconsistency at the meta level to draw conclusions, but we can also look at results of the following kind, that certain combinations of structural features are inconsistent in the sense that any category with this combination must collapse or trivialize in some way. And this can be seen as a kind of logical or structural no-go theorem. So a classic in this genre in categorical logic is Royale's lemma, which says that the only Boolean categories are Boolean algebras. Or to say that a bit more carefully, if we assume that a Cartesian closed category, which embodies the intuitionistic logic of conjunction and implication, not just in terms of provability, but actually giving you sort of substantive things to correspond to proofs and their behavior under cut elimination and so on, and which corresponds to lambda calculus, in fact. So suppose we added to that the feature that it had a negation with classical properties, an involutive negation. Then, so we might just think we could carry through the program of this sort of computational and categorical interpretation of logic for classical logic. But if we do that, then the structure actually collapses to a preorder, which from the categorical point of view is a triviality because there's at most one arrow between any pair of objects. So you lose all the information about the proof and you're left only with the relation of provability or entailment. So hence the slogan that the only Boolean categories are Boolean algebras. Now, this kind of idea, I mean, in the some recent work that I've done, can be related to quantum issues of no cloning and no deleting. In particular there, what we're looking at is an incompatibility between features that have been shown to be inherent in some of the sort of key quantum aspects of behavior of entangled systems and so forth, namely compact structure, and having a uniform copying operation. So a diagonal now, not just with point naturality and monoidality, but the general case of those properties. So a copying operation with the right logical properties, which would sort of relate to substitution and so forth. And the result there, the collapse there, is that a compact closed category with uniform copying is subject to the following kind of collapse. That every endomorphism is a scalar multiple of the identity. So all the endomorphism algebras are just, in linear algebra terms, are just one-dimensional things. They just collapse. And the proof is a sort of robust topological argument. It can be extended to a broadcasting theorem, and there's some connections with no deleting. So we see a sort of connection between limitative results in logic and no-go theorems in quantum mechanics. My sense is that there could be similar connections between these issues to do with diagonals and physical issues. Now, there is some literature developing Lorvier's ideas from the viewpoint of computer science to draw out some inconsistencies of this kind. So here we're assuming as a feature, a structural feature of a category that has this fixed point property at every object, that every object has the property that every endomorphism has a fixed point. This is true for many of for linear categories and similar things with some kind of base point that has to be preserved by homomorphisms in quite a trivial fashion. But in computer science, it holds in a more interesting way because the requirements of semantics of programming languages, where you need to interpret recursion by fixed points, leads to developing a subject known as domain theory, which precisely produces Cartesian closed categories with this fixed point property. And the question we might ask is this consistent with the kind of logical structure that you have in topuses and other things that carry large amounts of logic and set theory? And the answer is if you, certainly if you do it naively, is no. So here's a typical example of such a result. I don't even assume Cartesian closure here. I just assume that there are finite products and co-products, which form a nice, what's known as a distributive category, where the products distribute over the co-products in the way that you would expect. And we suppose that every object has the fixed point property. So the first thing is something that is certainly possessed by the category of sets and all topuses and many, many other things. And the second is this property that is possessed by various algebraic categories and also by categories of domains. If you put them together, you get an inconsistency. The category collapses in the worst possible way and all objects are isomorphic to one. So I won't sort of go through this, which is a sketch of the proof anyway, but it's but essentially here we're just, if you're in a Boolean algebra and you assume that negation has a fixed point, you can quite easily derive a contradiction. And the idea is that 1 plus 1 is giving you a little Boolean algebra living inside the category that behaves sufficiently like the classical one that you can make the same argument and then use that to confuse left and right injections and hence get this kind of collapse, which on a gross scale is not unlike the, is actually quite similar to the basic procedure in the proof about no cloning that I just mentioned, where in that case we confuse the identity and twist maps on a tensor product. So if you confuse structural maps that ought to be different, it's quite likely to lead to a collapse of the structure. And again, there are many variations on this theme. So there are many incompatibilities with having fixed points. So as always with these things, you have a sort of balance of features, and you might cling to one particular kind of feature and then see that you can't have another one. But from another point of view, it might be the other one that's the natural feature, and you see you can't approximate the first kind. If I still have a couple of minutes left, Harvey, I'd just like to finish off by saying just a word about self-reference in Hilbert spaces, just to bring the whole topic to connect with that. So basic point I want to make is that linear or monoidal categories such as Hilbert don't have diagonals, and in some sense are less subject to inconsistencies. We can, and therefore we can perfectly meaningfully ask the question, what forms of self-reference are possible there? So in particular, can we find weakly point surjective maps living in Hilbert spaces? Which at least is a kind of question that at least I haven't seen asked before, and is really, as in the way we've said, is asking about the capacity of Hilbert spaces to have some kind of self-referential structure. And again, if we just instantiate the general definition we saw earlier, we're asking for a function g with the property that for every function h, k-valued function on h, there is some vector that represents f in the sense that for all input vectors phi, so this psi is coding for the given function f, so the evaluating g on this gives us back what f would have done. So we have lots of experts here, so I don't know if we, if anyone would like to venture a suggestion as to what they would expect about the extent to which Hilbert spaces can do this. Well, there's one very well-known case, which is that of just of linear functionals, where the value space is just the ground field. And of course, we know it's standard that in Hilbert spaces, for every linear functional is represented by a vector through the inner product structure. So we know that. And we can turn that into a weakly point surjective map if we compose with a basis-independent isomorphism, a basis-dependent isomorphism from H to its dual space, just to get the types right, just to allow for the fact that in the complex structure we have a sesquilinear inner product. So for linear functionals, we actually do know about weakly point surjective maps. What about where the target space is richer than just a complex number? So for finite dimensional spaces, we can't go beyond this, just for dimensional reasons. So the place to look for interesting reflexive behavior, as indeed we might expect, is with infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces H. And what we'll just, I'll just finish up by doing very briefly, is to show how to get a weakly point surjective map when H is infinite dimensional and K is finite dimensional, which I think is the best we can do. And this relates to important aspects of Hilbert's work, Hilbert spaces and the Hilbert hotel, which is his famous discussion, sort of popular discussion of the strange features of infinite cardinality. So the first thing we know is that if two Hilbert spaces have the same dimension, they're isomorphic, which tells us that for infinite dimensional Hilbert space H, we have these isomorphisms between H tensor H and H biproduct H and H, or it's some H and H, which just reflect these cardinality isomorphisms, which is the mathematical content of the Hilbert hotel. Always enough room at the Hilbert hotel, even for infinitely many guests and so forth. Or infinitely many coach parties, each of which brings infinitely many guests. So we have these isomorphisms, and we want to represent a function of this kind. So this could be qubits or some array of qubits, so some kind of space of values into which we can separate out features of the Hilbert space H. So given such a map, a predicate in this generalized sense. Obviously, since this is a product, we can write it as a tuple of maps where each of them is a linear functional. And now by simply putting together some of these isomorphisms, we see that we can construct a weakly point surjective map. So there is indeed plenty of room in Hilbert space, even for a certain amount of self-reference, but done linearly, so it doesn't create any paradoxes. Okay, so I'll finish there. Thanks.